week's edition of World Crisis Radio. This is your host, Webster Tarpley, in Washington, D.C. Now, we're recording our program here on the afternoon of a fateful Friday, February 20th, and the bottom is falling out of Wall Street. That's really nothing new. This has been hemorrhaging for quite a while. But a couple of milestones have been passed, and I guess the principal one, first of all, is that Citibank, the stock of this conglomerate of usury and derivatives and toxic paper, has gone below $2 a share. It's really not a stock anymore. It's an option on some kind of government payment in the future. So Citibank goes below $2 a share, and General Motors has declined below a market capital of $1 billion. That means if you take the number of outstanding shares of General Motors, you multiply them by the stock price, you get less than $1 billion. Now, this, I think, rather neatly sums up the situation that we're in right now. The background on the banking side, which I think defines the crisis for us, also in terms of what you do to get out of it, it's clear, of course, that Obama's measures, even though they're tailored to pander to these banks, are not effective. And, of course, the reason they're not effective is that it is physically impossible to stop a panic. You cannot approach a bubble which has already busted open, which is already in the process of inexorable collapse, and attempt to turn it around. There are examples like this, of course, in nature, right? One that comes to mind is the thermite reaction, which people involved in 9/11 Truth studied. The thermite reaction, once started, cannot be stopped by any known means. So the thermite reaction is a one-way ticket. The same thing happens with a bubble. We are inside. You got to imagine us walking around on the interior surface. We're now inhabiting the negative curvature of the inside of a collapsing bubble. This is the fundamental reality. There is no means on Earth, in the physical universe as presently constituted, that you can stop a collapsing bubble with any kind of action. There's literally nothing you can do. Once the panic sets in, the panic takes on a life of its own, and down, down, down it comes. And there is no bottom. There is no cycle. The absurd yin and yang preached by the Austrian school of the trade cycle, the business cycle, is simply obfuscation. This is Taoism, I guess, imported from ancient China, or the traditional seasonal outlook of the illiterate peasant, I guess, codified into some kind of pseudo-economic doctrine. There is no automatic recovery from a depression. It's generally political events of some kind that lead you out of it. And in this case, the only way to get out of it is to adopt the policies that will get you out of it. So we're inside this bubble. Now, you can blame Obama for the fact that the stock market has gone down 25% or whatever it is since he won the election, and certainly it's gone down 10% in the last 10 days. It's probably going to be more by the time today is over. But this is not fundamental. Don't look at the price of paper. Don't look at paper values of any kind. They started off bloated, cancerous, fictitious, speculative. You've had decades of a casino economy. You've had decades and decades of an economy based on risk. And in particular, the moment that set you on this path, in addition to the moments of deindustrialization under Carter Volcker and the moment of deregulation of derivatives under Greenspan and Reagan and Clinton and Rubin, the one that you've got to look at is the great deregulation, the granddaddy of all the deregulations, August 15th, 1971, Nixon, Arthur Burns, Texas John Connolly, and the rest of these idiots who wantonly destroyed the system of Bretton Woods fixed parities from the Bretton Woods 1944 World Economic Summit, which set up the most successful monetary system the world had ever known up to that time. Not perfect. We could improve it in many, many ways today, but better than anything that had ever been available, and certainly better than the British pound-based system, which had been enforced from the end of the Napoleonic Wars in 1815 until 1944. So we're dealing with the combined results of deregulation, derivatives, currencies, and deindustrialization. The 22% prime rate, meaning 25 to 30% or 35% for many lenders under Volcker at the Federal Reserve. So you're now inside a collapsing bubble. There is no bottom for Citibank. There's no bottom for any of these banks. We can look at the evolution in the last couple of weeks in just a minute. But this is now the problem, that you've got to turn your attention away from the collapsing paper prices. Your problem is not the price of housing. Who cares what the average price of a home is? The question is, do you have enough of them? Are you able to house your population in your existing housing stock? What's the condition of that housing stock? Does the roof leak? Does the plumbing work? Not the price. Forget the price. And I guess today it's time to remind everybody, with the Dow approaching, what, down 200 as we're recording this here on Friday afternoon, and these bank stocks leading the way. Looks like Citibank is down 20 to 25% in one day. We can go back. Let's just go back for a second. I think that the really serious collapse now started on Tuesday, February 17th. This is about 1 week after the abortive debacle of Geithner, the Secretary of the Treasury, who has just simply shown that not only is he a tax evader, he's an Al Capone sitting in the Treasury Department and running the IRS. He's also simply an incompetent. On the 17th of February, the overall market was down about, what, 4%, I guess it was. But the really ominous thing is when you look at these bank stocks, J.P. Morgan Chase down 9.3%. This was last Tuesday, February 17th. Union Bank of Switzerland down 8%. That one has collapsed in the meantime because it turns out that they are assisting people in tax evasion. Citibank down 10%. Morgan Stanley down 12.2%. Goldman Sachs down 9.5%. Bank of America down 10%. Metropolitan Life Insurance Company down 8%. Prudential down 13.3%. The Hartford Insurance Company is down 15.5%. So you get the idea. This is a terrible situation. Only among the insurers, only the Travelers, for some reason, holds up with a 2.2% fall. Wonder what they're doing. Maybe they didn't buy derivatives. Who knows? But for the rest of them, this is now a world economic depression of incalculable proportions. There is no bottom unless you force a bottom. And that's not in stocks, but in real economy.
Are you tired of searching for great talk radio? Well, search no more. We are the GCN Radio Network.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. And what we're following, of course, is that in this past week, recording here on the afternoon of February 20th, the pace of the world economic financial depression, the Bush derivatives, world economic and financial depression, a genocidal depression, the worst financial collapse in human history so far, because it represents capital structures going back, in some respects, to the foundation of the Bank of England about 1700 in the 1690s, with Sir Isaac Newton as one of the original shareholders, along with John Locke. You look at these British scoundrels of the mind. The Bank of England capital structures that are 300 years old. You've got capital structures in there on the U.S. side that are at least 100 years old from the assertion of the Morgan hegemony in Wall Street in 1895, and so on. And in particular, you've got the capital structures post-1945, and you've got the effects of this asset bubble. There has been a worldwide speculative asset bubble going on for decades. Call it irrational exuberance, call it what you will. But that, of course, look at the stock market peaked at 14,000. In 2007, 2008, back in 1987, 20 years before, it had been around 2,000. Does that mean that production, employment, and real economics had grown by 700% from about a 2,000 Dow to a 14,000 Dow? Of course not. It meant nothing of the kind. If anything, the real wages had stagnated or in some cases declined, and the industrial production of the United States had declined. The steel industry had basically fallen apart. Heavy chemical, fallen apart. Rubber, fallen apart. And so on down the line. Now, some supplement came in through computer manufacturing and healthcare, but you've got to have a full set economy, including basic industries. So the main point of all this is the market is wrong. You cannot make economic policy based on the price of paper. Who cares what the market thinks that paper is worth at any given time? That may be correct, or it may be absolutely insane, because you're dealing, of course, with human beings, very suggestible, very prone to error, and overall sometimes hysterical in asset manias and bubbles, and that's what we've had. The Anglo-American dollar-based system has been a casino economy, a bubble economy, where the market has been telling you one thing, that wealth was growing, and the reality around you was a crumbling and decaying society with declining standards of living, down by two-thirds since about 1966, 1967, and certainly declining levels of industrial production and per capita in particular, right? Industrial production per capita. And then as soon as you get into the qualitative measures about what a modern living standard ought to be so that people could function at the level of 21st century technology, well, then it's even more unfortunate and falls even further short. So that is the negative curvature which we now inhabit. We're inside this bubble. We see a negative curvature. The horizon comes up in front of us. We're in a pseudosphere or something of this sort. So don't think that you're living in normal times. And above all, please don't use the nostrums of the stuff that the right-wing parrots of the afternoon are talking about, right? That there are losers and that Obama wants to bail out the losers. No, dear friends. As you probably know, Limbaugh, Hannity, O'Reilly, and the rest of you, Obama is bailing out mortgage lenders. His program does almost nothing for people who are going to lose their homes. It may do a little bit, but the main emphasis on it is to save mortgage lenders as a means of saving the banks. So remember that Obama is not Franklin D. Roosevelt. He is the opposite of Franklin D. Roosevelt. He's not the New Deal. He's the anti-New Deal. He is Herbert Hoover. Very interesting piece up on rents this week by Bruce Marshall. We found out what the H in Obama stands for. Remember, it was taboo to call him Hussein? Well, we know what the H stands for now. He's Barack Hoover Obama. Barack Herbert Hoover Obama. We can call him Barack Hoover Obama for short, because what he's proposing is a colossal version of the Reconstruction Finance Corporation. And this is going to fail. There are positive features within this. And one of the functions of this broadcast is to instruct people to the point where they can distinguish the positive features even of something like the stimulus bill, because it has positive features, make no mistake, but also to identify the overwhelming negative features, which come in the form of payments essentially to bankers and financier interests with this futile, hopeless, lunatic agenda of trying to prop up a speculative bubble which has already been burst. Now let's just look at the situation here this afternoon. After that Tuesday turning point, the situation we're now going into, Japan was about down about 2% overnight, Hong Kong down 2.5%, Singapore down 2%, and so forth. Europe is also getting clobbered today. The FTSE in England down 3%. The DAX, of course, the German formerly industrialized economy, down 5%. They get hit harder because they have residues of industry. The British have basically nothing left. The French are sort of half and half between the two, down 4.5% this Friday, February 20th. But now let's look at the carnage among these banks today. Again, it started on Tuesday in the current form, and we're now in a panic out of the Anglo-American banking system. J.P. Morgan Chase now ensconced at 19 1/3, down 6.5%. Union Bank of Switzerland has taken a tremendous beating this week because of their they've been attacked by the Department of Justice. They've been forced to disgorge the names of finance oligarchs that have given them money for tax evasion purposes, made a little Madoffs and so forth. Union Bank of Switzerland lost a lot of its value, but today it's down 12.5% just today. Now, Citibank, the losses in Citibank, this is the epicenter of the crisis right now. Citibank is now down 26% as I talk to you. It is at $1.87 per share. Let's talk about Citibank in a minute. Morgan Stanley down 6.5%. Goldman Sachs down 6.6%. You get the picture. We'll look at some insurance companies here, but let's pause for a second with Citibank. Citibank has now been bailed out twice. Citibank was bailed out once in September, October with the original TARP. They got, I believe, $25 billion, or was it $30 to $35 billion? They were bailed out again in December with a Swiss-style insurance plan, and now Citibank is going bankrupt for the third time. What do we need to learn from the third bankruptcy of Citibank? Back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
In Washington, D.C. I would also call your attention to something like Metropolitan Life Insurance Company, a huge complex of interests, down 10.5% in one day. And if we look at Prudential there, over there in Newark, let's see how they're doing here with our little quote finder, right? Whatever it is. Oh, they're down. Prudential is now down. Well, something similar. That would be Prudential Insurance and all of their essential derivatives. So this is now the death agony of the banks. Remember, you're still in the relatively early phases of a world financial and economic depression. The previous time around, just for guidelines, it took from October 1929 to, essentially the spring of 1933 to reach a bottom. And there was no automatic bottom. The bottom was created by the actions of Franklin D. Roosevelt and the New Deal. And without those actions, you were on a course leading towards something like the Nazi war economy with concentration camps. That was avoided in the United States thanks to Roosevelt, and I guess that's the best way to judge Roosevelt. We'll try to dedicate a segment again, this time to this awful book by Calamity Schles. However, the reason that the bank stocks are doing so poorly, among other things, this morning, the Financial Times of London had published an article speculating, in the mind, that is, I guess, and also by selling short, that Citibank was going to be nationalized by the Obama regime. And it's thought that in the course of that nationalization, the holders of the common stock of something like Citibank will be completely wiped out. So people essentially flee that stock. Now we look at the news, of course, that J.P. Morgan is not far behind, ought to tell us that this is not simply a Citibank crisis, but a general crisis of the entire casino economy, bubble economy, and the centerpiece of that, of course, what you don't hear about in too many places, the question of derivatives. Remember, the credit default swaps, the collateralized debt obligations, the structured investment vehicles, the asset-backed securities, the mortgage-backed securities, securitization of all kinds. Anytime you have paper based on paper, a paper instrument which is not based on some allegedly real-world item or asset, but a piece of paper that's based on another piece of paper, that's a derivative. Anything that has an option built in it is a derivative, because options and futures, of course, are based on the underlying property titles, be they stocks, bonds, or what currencies or whatever else they are. So paper based on paper has been the watchword of this economy. That is what has created all this risk. The biggest factor in the risk is the demolition of the Bretton Woods system, because now you have currency risk built in. As I'm talking now, Citibank is down 29% in one day. 29%. At $1.79, you can buy a share of Citibank, but don't do it unless you're getting down to the price where you can use it for wallpaper, I guess. This is a serious situation, and again, the rumor on nationalization started this week. Was stoked by Greenspan in particular. Very, very interesting. Greenspan, of course, is not only is a scoundrel, of course he's a scoundrel, but he's also a lunatic, a crackpot. He's, of course, one of your free market boys. He's up there with the Austrians and the Chicago School and Milton Friedman. And in particular, Greenspan's special wrinkle is that he's a follower of Ayn Rand, right, the Nietzschean theoretician of the Hobbesian struggle of all against all, and that man is a wolf to the rest of mankind. He had talked about nationalizing the bank, saying, oh, woe is me. I've got to throw away my ideological proclivities and now call for the nationalization of the banks. And that had been picked up on the same day by liberal Republican Senator Lindsey Graham, the sidekick of McCain, right, the amigo of McCain during the election campaign. He also wants the banks nationalized. And we had some people writing in the Washington Post, the house organ of the Federal Reserve, that it might be time to nationalize the banks. Now, what do they mean by nationalize the banks? If you look at those banks that we've been mentioning, J.P. Morgan down 8.5 today, Citibank down 30% now today. If you look at Bank of America, similar losses. Well, what you find there is that they ought to be seized by the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. So should Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs, now that they are allegedly bank holding companies themselves. If bank has between 10, 12%, certainly 15% of non-performing assets, then it's bankrupt. And Sheila Bair of the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, a very good New Deal institution, which most everybody with a brain is very glad to have, although it interferes with the free market and was roundly condemned by the Austrians and the Chicago boys and all the rest of them all those years. It's not a free market institution. It's a dirigist, mercantilist, protectionist, American system, New Deal institution. Well, the FDIC under Sheila Bair ought to intervene and seize J.P. Morgan Chase, Citibank, and Bank of America, to name just those, but also Morgan Stanley and Goldman Sachs now, because they claim to be banks too. So get them. They're bankrupt, just as bankrupt as the others, and even the market. Citibank now down 31% just in the time that I'm talking. The rush for the exits is on. The panic is still with us. The panic comes in waves, and you can see it on a day like this. Well, Sheila Bair ought to seize, by the close of business today, Friday the 20th of February, Sheila Bair ought to seize those banks. And what would you do with those banks? You don't have any option except to put them through Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings. And what we need to secure is the idea that in the bankruptcy reorganization of those banks, which in my opinion would probably lead to their liquidation, in other words, it would turn from Chapter 11 reorganization into Chapter 7 termination, wiping them out, because they've got trillions and trillions of dollars. In the case of J.P. Morgan, they admit to having 100 trillion of derivatives, 100 trillion. If you're going to put them through Chapter 11 bankruptcy proceedings, then those have got to be wiped out. And that is, I think, what the idea of these financier spokesmen is. Greenspan says, well, we better nationalize them because that's the only way we can save them from bankruptcy. And in the course of that bankruptcy, if you knock out those banks, you've basically punched a hole in the $1.5 quadrillion derivatives bubble, and very little of the derivatives bubble will be remaining. So the actions by these financier spokesmen have as their exclusive goal, in reality, the preservation of the possibility of a derivative bubble. And that's, of course, what the rest of us have got to labor mightily to wipe out. The basic approach, I've said it many times, wipe out derivatives. There will be no economic recovery as long as the derivatives bubble persists. We had another estimate this week, one email that came to me, and it had some backing. There was a website that talked about it, was that the derivatives bubble had actually reached 1.8 quadrillion. It was approaching 2 quadrillion last year. We don't know what it is now. We don't know anything because these derivatives are not reportable. You're always working with estimates. Citibank is now down 35%, $1.64 for a Citibank share. Amazing. The derivatives are unknown in their true amount, but I think a good estimate is still the 1.5 quadrillion, 1.5 thousand trillion. The only thing to do is wipe them out, shred them, delete them, get them out of the world. Wipe them out, and you will have cleared the decks for recovery, which you then have to organize. Back in a minute. Radio. This is Webster Topley, your host here in Washington, D.C., calling your kind attention to my books on Obama, the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, available at Amazon.com and elsewhere, many fine bookshops, and some of them on the Internet. I think Alex Jones is selling that and some others. I also recommend Barack H. Obama. Now we know it's Barack Hoover Obama, the unauthorized biography. Biography is destiny. You want to know what he's going to do, you better look at his biography, and it better be the real one, not the fake one. And I'm happy to announce that Making Progress Towards the Press right now as we speak is Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide Through the Greatest Financial Crisis in Human History, Greatest Economic and Financial Crisis in Human History. The original edition of that goes back to the end of 1998, beginning in 1999, and it's a snapshot of all the tendencies that have taken us to the present worldwide breakdown crisis, the death agony of the Anglo-American banking system, the death agony of the dollar, the death agony of this speculative casino bubble economy of derivatives, which has been imposed by all of these bankers taking over the government. Remember, Wall Street is the enemy. Wall Street makes the government the enemy to the extent that Wall Street controls the government, to the extent that you control the government. That changes. I'm noting now that Bank of America down 31% this afternoon, down 31% in one day, meaning Bank of America stock is basically on the road to being an option. Citibank down now 31%. Also, we've got some races to the bottom going. The Dow is racing the Nikkei to the bottom. They were both at about 7,500 a few days ago, and they're headed down. And Citibank is racing Bank of America towards the abyss. Looks like the plunge protection team is concentrating its resources on J.P. Morgan Chase, which is down only 7.25%, holding at $19.10 a share. They're also trying to defend Morgan Stanley and particularly Goldman Sachs. But in the meantime, now the overall market has gone to an 11-year low. This is the worst it's been since the early phase of the Asian contagion, or the Asian contagion, in 1997. So that's an 11-year low on the overall Dow. So nationalization, I don't know what they mean by nationalization. Those banks have got to be seized. And the principal reason to seize them, and especially to seize J.P. Morgan Chase, which is the worst of them in this regard, they admit they have 100 trillion of derivatives. I would estimate 300 trillion to 400 trillion of derivatives under the control of Jamie Dimon, our dear friend running the J.P. Morgan Chase operation. This is a true derivatives monster. You can go back to some interesting postings on the internet some years back. J.P. Morgan derivatives monster. J.P. Morgan derivatives monster grows. J.P. Morgan derivatives monster implodes. That was in 2002. You can find that on the internet. One of the gold bug sites put that up, and it's fundamentally accurate. You get an idea of the role of derivatives in J.P. Morgan. The goal of nationalization for them is to preserve derivatives. The goal of nationalization, if that's what it is, I would just call it seizure. Bank regulators should seize these things. Citibank, of course, was seized back in 1990. You can read about that in Surviving the Cataclysm. It was kept secret at the time. It was done in the dead of night. It was a stealth attack of bank regulators, and they seized Citibank. These derivatives monsters have now got to be seized by the government. Yes, by the government. They're the only ones who are going to seize them. And they have got to be wound up. Their derivatives book has got to be wound up. Their derivatives have got to be wiped off the books, deleted, shredded, burned, used as wallpaper. I think most of them are in electronic form, but you get the idea. The only way you get out of this depression is through the systematic destruction of derivatives. What has gone on in the background is a very interesting debate within the ruling class, and I hope that our listeners are aware of this. Paulson started with the original TARP, $700 billion, and that was in September, October. And Paulson came forward after Lehman Brothers had gone down and AIG and Merrill had been acquired. And Paulson came forward and said, I need $700 billion to buy up toxic assets and remove them from the balance sheets of the banks. Within several weeks, it became obvious that you couldn't do it. The reason for it is clear. It has never been said in any public media that I've seen, is that you can't tackle the problem because the derivatives are too many. The amount of money is too large. It's 1.5 thousand trillion of derivatives, 1.5 quadrillion worldwide. Say a quadrillion of that is in the U.S. Maybe the rest of it is in Europe and Japan. But if it's 1,000 trillion of derivatives, what are you going to do with 0.7 trillion to neutralize that toxic paper? Now, that problem has now been inherited by Geithner, given the fact that he's a finance oligarch from the same school as Paulson, with a slightly different pedigree, a little bit less Goldman Sachs, a little bit more IMF, a little bit more Kissinger Associates. This little demon, right, this pointy-eared little evil gnome, Geithner, has come in and he said, well, I'll now create a bad bank and I'll use my bad bank to make that a receptacle and a toxic waste site for these derivatives. And the big debacle that he had about 10 days ago now, I think on the 10th, Monday, the Tuesday, week ago Tuesday, Geithner found that he too ran up against this fact that the derivatives are astronomical in size and cannot be dealt with in any normal way. There is no bad bank. There is not enough money in the world to deal with these derivatives. Only one thing to do, wipe them out. Wipe the slate, right? Go to the chalkboard and wash it with the sponge. Shred, delete, burn, gone, no derivatives. Get the picture. This is an absolute prerequisite for the survival of human civilization. There can't be anything left that calls itself a derivative. And, of course, the Austrians will say, yeah, but that violates the free market. What if these people think that derivatives have value? There's got to be a political decision by an enraged public and a mobilized humanity. Derivatives are incompatible with the future of human civilization, and they must go. They also have no value. This is a real problem of epistemology. Finance oligarchs believe that derivatives have value. They have negative value, like the old Rasputnik of Al Cap. If the more derivatives you have, the poorer you are, because you've got to pay the carters, right? You've got to pay some garbage company to come and take them away. They're a public nuisance. Get rid of derivatives. So now we've got the original TARP with Paulson couldn't tackle derivatives. The bad bank TARP with Geithner couldn't do it. There was this interlude back in December when the Swiss model of bailout, which had been used by the Swiss government on Union Bank of Switzerland, which is also going down now, down 13% as we speak, and has been tremendously pummeled during the week. There was this attempt to apply that. It just doesn't work. So you've got to turn away from that and go back to the application of the law. It has that advantage. It is the legality of the thing. The Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation should seize these banks and wipe out their derivatives books. And I'm pretty sure that for the top four, five, six banks, money center banks, you know the ones, there'll be nothing left. So that will turn into Chapter 7. At that point, you could then wipe out derivatives in the other banks. Some of them might survive. And then using your nationalized Federal Reserve as a Bureau of the Treasury, you begin to put out $1 trillion of credit as an initial tranche to provide credit, 1%, 0% credit, probably now that the Depression has gotten worse, for your various infrastructure projects, your 100 nuclear reactors, your transcontinental maglev, your space program, your regional TVA-style projects and export projects for other countries that you can finance to create jobs. We'll be back in a minute. Crisis Radio, your host Webster Tarpley here in Washington, D.C. We've just had a voice from the grave, Fright Night, the monster, Paul Adolf Volcker, the protagonist of the 22% prime rate under the Jimmy Carter trilateral regime. Paul Adolf Volcker currently ensconced in the Obama White House, leading that Volcker board, that collection of monetarist thugs and Keynesian thugs and other thugs, has just made a speech at Columbia University where he says that the pace of collapse of the world economy is probably faster now than it was in the Great Depression of the 1930s. And with Citibank below $2 a share, with General Motors market cap below $1 billion, with Citibank, with the Bank of America having lost almost a third of its value in one day. Paul Adolf Volcker probably has a point. What he forgot to say, though, was that his deindustrialization of the United States, the destruction of the U.S. heavy industrial base, carried out by Volcker with the support of Carter, David Rockefeller, and the trilateral gang, same people who own and run Barkey Obama, that deindustrialization of the United States by making production such a strange foreign alien concept has been one of the two or three most important factors in real economic terms, of course, probably the most important factor in creating the current world economic breakdown crisis, death agony of the dollar, death agony of the Anglo-American banking system. Just a couple of other statistics here. Prudential Insurance is down about 8.5%. They're sitting pretty compared to AIG. AIG, of course, has already gone bankrupt, but the U.S. government stands behind AIG. They've lost 15% today, and AIG is down there about, what, a dollar a share? Something like that, between $1 and $2 a share for AIG. The Hartford Insurance Company, down 22%. Now, you're going to let them insure you, or you insure them, right? who's got a better chance of living to the end of the day, you or the Hartford, when it turns out that you've got a better chance than surviving the next week or the next month in the Hartford, then it's time to wonder, what are you paying for in terms of insurance? Same thing with AIG. Now, that points to the fact that these insurance companies, of course, have gone all the way into derivatives. It's a crime. The derivatives should never have been allowed. They've got to be deregulated out of the world, right? You know how it happened. Franklin D. Roosevelt wisely banned the then equivalents of derivatives, meaning options. They were considered illegal in many ways from 1936 to 1982. Reagan, so much admired by the financier crowd, legalized them. Wendy Graham emphatically legalized them. And Greenspan and Bob Rubin of Goldman Sachs and now of Citibank made sure that derivatives were visited upon the world against the efforts of Brooks Liebhorn at the Commodity Futures Trading Commission. So they've got to be re-regulated out of the world. Adjustable rate mortgages have got to be made illegal. Hedge funds have got to be illegal. In other words, they've got to be re-regulated. And since a hedge fund is by definition deregulated, as soon as you re-regulate it, no more hedge fund. That would be a big step forward. The markets, notice gasoline creeping up, not today, but other days, that's also got to be re-regulated. So take all of the nostrums of the Chicago boys and the Austrians and all the monetarists and all the British and throw them out the window. We did have Larry Summers this week of the Obama regime giving his personal creed, which is to support John Maynard Keynes. John Maynard Keynes is not the New Deal. John Maynard Keynes tried to promote himself by claiming that he had something to do with the New Deal. This is not the case. You go and look in the speeches of Franklin D. Roosevelt and tell me any place where he endorses John Maynard Keynes. He does not, and with good reason. John Maynard Keynes is an agent of the City of London. He's personally a degenerate, to say the least. But in particular, he did get into a fight with Churchill in the 1920s. That was his interesting moment. He was not happy with the Treaty of Versailles. He said this was incompetent imperialism, right? The economic consequences of the peace, and then later on the economic consequences of Mr. Churchill. But by the time we get into the 1930s, John Maynard Keynes is a totalitarian liberal. He believes in the kind of stuff you see with Barkey. In other words, a liberal government, meaning a banker's regime, which attempts to intervene in all sorts of areas of society for the purpose of saving the bankers and doing it in a totalitarian manner, but not using so much the Hitler or Mussolini approach, but more like the British approach. That's basically Keynes. Notice that Keynes says, you've got to hire people to do things that are useless. Well, why is that, Keynes? Because if you hire them to do things that are useful, then you'll drive the free market boys, the private capital people, out of those areas. But wait a minute, what if those private capital guys don't do what is necessary? Case in point, Tennessee Valley Authority. Keynes would say that's very bad because that it means that you're having the government create rural electrification in the Tennessee Valley, fighting malaria, fighting floods, providing hydroelectric power modernization. The basis of the New South, the basis of the Sun Belt you see today, is the Tennessee Valley Authority, a New Deal institution. Keynes would say that's very bad because you've driven the private guys out. Well, they weren't going to do it, John Maynard. There were no way they were going to do it, so don't give us that fairy tale. That's usually then brought as an argument to privatize something that the people have paid for and put that into the hands of privateers. The other thing about Keynes you got to know, at the Bretton Woods Conference itself in 1944, he came on the scene as an overt enemy of the United States. He was pushing something called Bancor. Instead of having a worldwide monetary system with the dollar as the reserve currency and gold convertibility of the dollar, Keynes didn't want any of that. Keynes was interested in the possibility of the British to have competitive devaluations, to use currency chaos for economic warfare is what it came down to. So Keynes came to Bretton Woods and he said, let's have Bancor, meaning funny money, kind of special drawing rights back there in 1944. And basically it was a way that the British could continue to milk and bilk the entire system. He was defeated by the Roosevelt administration at Bretton Woods and his plan did not pass. But that's Keynes. And, of course, in terms of his philosophy, he's a Malthusian. He believes that there's a surplus which has got to be not invested, but consumed. He thinks that there's an absolute surplus in society, which comes on the scene for him in the moment of a crisis of overproduction. And Malthus had recommended that you have a state clergy, that you'd have the clergymen of the Church of England, the Episcopal ministers on their livings, that they would consume the surplus so you wouldn't get a crisis of overproduction. Keynes said, well, this is the modern day. What we've got to do is pay people to dig ditches and then fill them up. Meaningless, useless work that does not improve the infrastructure of society, because that would compete with the private sector and prevent recovery, but something that will try to consume the surplus. So in many ways, most of the people talking today are Keynesian. They believe that increasing commodity turnover, pump priming, putting money into the system will somehow create a recovery. It does not. It doesn't work that way. You've got to have great works of infrastructure, the things we've talked about, the 100 nuclear reactors to rebuild the grid, the urban mass transit in the main cities, the transcontinental magnetic levitation railway, the space program. You've got to have your infrastructure on the one side, extremely modern, up-to-date, modern technology, no gangrene jobs, and then you've got to have your science drivers, your space program, your biomedical, your high-energy physics, so that you're getting new innovations to modernize your productive process and come out of a depression. We'll be back in a minute.
This is Cascadia Public Radio.
In Washington, D.C., the Barkey Obama White House has just given a touching reassurance of their belief in a privately owned banking system. Barkey punting for the moment. Senator Dodd, the profiteering chair of the Senate Banking Committee, says some banks needed to be nationalized for a short time. That's so the derivatives can be transferred to you, and you become the bad bank. That would essentially make the U.S. government into a bad bank for toxic derivatives. And again, it's about $1,000 trillion of derivatives. It can't be done. There's no way. The only way out of this, of course, the demagogy of the various parrots of the afternoon, is that they never talk about derivatives. If you have only listened to Limbaugh, I think you've heard the word derivatives once. In the past week, I think, some cut coming from, the famous Santelli rant. That's what it was. The Squawk Box, CNBC in the morning, they have their guy, Rick Santelli, from the Chicago Board of Trade. And he went through this big rant about subsidizing the losers. This is moral hazard. And he mentioned the word derivatives, though. And Limbaugh had that on there. That's the first time derivatives have ever been mentioned on Limbaugh, as far as I know. Limbaugh doesn't know what derivatives are. They do not exist. And nevertheless, they are the centerpiece of this bubble economy, this casino economic system. And again, no recovery if you don't destroy the derivatives. Now, let's look at Barkey's troubled relation to economic recovery. This past week, we had his window dressing attempt to pretend to do something for the little people while essentially convoying money into predatory lenders. And this is, of course, the plan on the housing crisis, the foreclosures, right? Turns out that approximately one-tenth of all mortgages in the United States are in trouble or will soon be in trouble. Therefore, one out of 10 homeowners may be threatened by foreclosure. Now, Barkey's plan, it's $50 billion. According to the Wall Street Journal, it's really $250 billion. Well, what is wrong with this plan? Well, better you should ask what's right with it. First of all, unless a bank is taking money from the TARP, in other words, unless they're on the take from the federal government, the plan is completely voluntary. There's nothing mandatory about it. So the bank can say, no, I'm sorry, I'm Ebenezer Scrooge, I'm Mr. Potter, and we're going to throw you out on the street. So that's obviously, that makes the whole thing a bad joke. What it does, though, is provide for payments to people like Angelo Mozzillo. Remember him, the gangster at Countrywide? Angelo Mozzillo will be delighted with this bill. Now, of course, he's out of there, but you get the idea. Barkey's plan for foreclosures is to provide monetary bribes to predatory lenders who have done things like sell people adjustable-rate mortgages, knowing that the poor little schmucks would never read the fine print and they would never know what hit them. And you've got these people on television now all the time. They never knew. They didn't know that ARM gun was loaded and so forth. So the one thing that any serious program of reform on the mortgage front would do is to outlaw the adjustable rate mortgage. It's got to be outlawed. You're going to buy a mortgage, it's got to be a piece of paper that says, the percentage rate on this mortgage for the next 15 or 30 years is X. And there it is, 5%. In my economy, probably one half of 1%. I could do it. Easy to do. You don't need to pay for this money, right? The people who have the money have been bilking the ones who don't have it. That's what monetarism comes down to. That's why they still talk about inflation as being such a big danger. Inflation is a danger to have to people who have money. If you have only debt, inflation is not so much of a danger. So the plan is based on payments, incentive payments to predatory lenders who have made these loans. Again, there's no discussion of derivatives, but let's see what we have here. Critics of this, Edward R. Morrison, professor at Columbia Law School, studying loan modification efforts. Foreclosures are expensive, and it's better to keep people in their homes. Yeah, not just for that, but because human life has to go on. Morris says, I don't think lenders need this buy-down help. Lenders already benefit from a loan modification. They don't need the extra gravy from a government handout. Why do we need to throw more money at the lenders? Throw more money at the lenders. Yes. Cash payments as incentives to predatory mortgage lenders, to the adjustable rate mortgage gang and others. And then, of course, the fact that this has been securitized. Many cases, as the newspaper coverage, is that it's hard to identify. It's hard to write things down. The modification program does not deal with the millions of loans sold into securitized pools known as private label securities, making them difficult to modify, financial service industry officials said here. This is the Washington Post of February 19th. Nothing about derivatives, because that's, of course, what that means. Securitized pools means derivatives. Derivatives. It focuses only on owner-occupied homes. That's fine. Primary residence is all that can be defended. But let me cut through this. The approach of Barkey is to give money to finance oligarchs and hope that they will let people stay in their homes. My approach is different. My approach says federal law wipes out the possibility that you're going to be foreclosed on. In other words, foreclosures are banned. Foreclosures become a federal crime. You've had so much malfeasance, so much fraud, so much adjustable rate mortgages, so much securitization, right? People sit in their houses and say, well, show me the original note that I signed. If you want to foreclose on me, show me the original note. And they say, well, that's been made into a derivative and sent to the other side of the world. No, show it to me. In this situation, the only thing you can do to avoid complete chaos is simple. If you want to stop foreclosures, stop foreclosures. Use the power of the state to stop foreclosures. set up a federal ban on foreclosures, you throw a family out in the street, you're looking on the inside of Leavenworth. Think of Angelo Mozzillo sitting in Leavenworth based on his first foreclosure on a family. And similarly, you've got to extend that across the economy. What you really need is an open-ended debt moratorium on all forms of financial debt, not trade debt, not producer to producer. But anytime a bank is involved, the bank itself is a sink and stew, a derivatives monster, and you've got to basically say, well, you know, we can't maintain cash payments into the derivatives black hole at the expense of human civilization. Back in a minute.
Thank you for listening to GCN. Be sure to visit GCNlive.com today.
Welcome back to World Crisis Radio. It's the fateful afternoon of February 20th, 2009, and the various banks, of course, Citibank has lost about 30% of its value in one day. Bank of America lost about 30% in one day. Clearly, J.P. Morgan Chase has been chosen by the regime, by the plunge protection team, as the winner out of all this. They're supposed to survive. The irony, of course, is that J.P. Morgan Chase has more derivatives than the other top three or four put together. So J.P. Morgan Chase of Jamie Dimon is absolutely the most bankrupt of all of these banks. It is the all-devouring Moloch of derivatives. It is the main locus of the bacchanalian orgy of derivatives that has gone on now for the past 15 years. Bank of America says they're fundamentally sound. They shouldn't be nationalized. Citibank says they're fundamentally sound and they shouldn't be nationalized. We had the poor spokes of the Barky Obama White House coming out and saying that Obama believes deeply in a privately owned banking system. The nationalization of these banks could take place this weekend. It will, of course, be done in the dead of night by a clique of financiers, and you will be sent the bill. Now, once you're sent the bill, that is the moment when you want to impugn and contest this. And again, the main issue, don't waste your time on the metaphysics of whether banks should be nationalized or not. That's not going to be the issue. The question is, what kind of credit triage should these banks go through? And above all, the demand is simple. Wipe out derivatives. The public, the American public, has never voted for derivatives. We never approve derivatives. We don't want derivatives. We want them regulated out of existence. The derivatives market has got to be re-regulated back to what it was between 1936 and 1982, when we did, on the whole, much better than we've done since with derivatives. The derivatives have destroyed the financial system. Not little schmoes in subprime shabby housing, but derivatives. And of course, once you identify derivatives as the cause, the reason it's a taboo to identify derivatives is that obviously no little schmo is out there selling derivatives, or very few. I don't know of any. Only bankers sell derivatives. Only hedge funds, counting houses, Goldman Sachs, Lehman Brothers, Bear Stearns, and banks, of course, have sold them, and insurance companies have bought them. Derivatives have no value. The market may tell you that derivatives have the market may tell you that derivatives do have value, dear Austrians and Chicagoites out there, but you've got to make an epistemological decision. The market is wrong. The market is tragically wrong. And if you follow the market, the destruction of civilization will result. And even today, by now, of course, after the panic, the market is telling you that they don't have any value. That's the problem in pricing derivatives. So now you can even do it with the good conscience that the market has told you that these things are worthless. So you get rid of derivatives. Now, again, Obama's plan on foreclosures is really a case in point for all of this stuff. He pretends to be helping the little people, and in reality, what he has created is incentives for lenders, cash incentives to predatory lenders, people who have sold adjustable rate mortgages, which never should have been legal, should have been stopped immediately. balloon notes being sold to unsuspecting little schmoes, a lot of them poor, a lot of them illiterate, a lot of them can't speak English, whatever it is. And that's it. Now, of course, the word from Wall Street is that if you solve housing, you solve the whole thing. No. The problem you have is the $1.5 quadrillion derivatives castle, as long as it was in positive leverage mode with those options honeycombed through it, as long as the option mode was positive, you were getting tremendous leverage at the top in terms of astronomical multiplication of predatory super profits. But now, as a result of a number of events, and one of them is the subprime mortgage and related stuff, that entire leverage machine has gone into negative leverage, meaning that what's being pyramided up at the top are astronomical, unbelievable losses. The only thing to do is get rid of it. And that should be done by government. So don't nationalize the banks in the sense that you're going to take them over and run them as they are. That would be insane. That would be suicidal. There's more than enough derivatives in J.P. Morgan Chase alone to drag down the entire U.S. federal government, the entire world, indeed the entire solar system and nearby interplanetary space can be destroyed by these derivatives. The contrasting case, of course, is the Detroit automakers. Should they be nationalized? Right now, as we said before, General Motors has fallen below $1 billion. So the market thinks that General Motors is only worth less than $1 billion. Well, that's wrong. If you want to have human civilization, if you want to have mass transit, if you want to have rail, if you want to have tractors, if you want to have retooling and reconversion for the space program, for building nuclear reactors on the assembly line, and a whole series of other modern forms of production, you need those factories. They are your future. If you think that that General Motors, the plant and equipment, is at such a low level, that is a hallucination. That is an example of how the blind fetishism of the market leads foolish dupes into suicidal behavior, and indeed can lead to the suicide of an entire civilization. Notice that the United Auto Workers have been forced to give sweeping concessions under the Barkey regime. Wait a minute. Barkey was supposed to be here for the little people to bring hope and change. Well, if you're a UAW worker, that's too bad for you, because you're now going to be dragged down to the level of the super exploited, terrified workers in those southern sweatshops, those runaway shops and sweatshops and low-wage auto plants that foreigners in particular have been putting into the Deep South, the land of the Taft-Hartley Act and the right-to-work laws, where there are no unions and therefore the workers have no rights, and you can drive them down to whatever you want, and the benefits, of course, are not comparable to the Detroit ones. Now, the point about this is you've got a limited pool of skilled manpower. You've got to have people who know how to make those plants work. You need those people. A lot of those UAW retirees could be brought back in, at least part-time, if you had an economic recovery. Therefore, Barkey is presiding over efforts to prop up the levels of speculative capital, which cannot be maintained, and he's turning a deaf ear to Detroit, and I think this is a colossal human tragedy. From the point of view of the human species as a whole, the factories of Detroit are an absolutely critical asset. And we're looking at the stock market. The plunge protection team has regrouped. Geithner, knowing that his neck is on the line, and Barkey also knowing that he's looking very, very bad, and with undoubtedly the help of Volcker and Summers and probably outside consultancy from Bullet Bob Rubin, who wants to save the price of his Citibank shares, even at this late date, his options, they've now got the losses pared down to minus 100 on the Dow this afternoon. It's now about 20 minutes after 2 Eastern time on the 20th of February, but that's just plunge protection team. Don't believe it. Notice also for our listeners on this network, gold is now above 1,000. So gold indeed is a shelter. If you want to have flight to quality, take it as 1,000. Interestingly, the free marketeers, the parents of the afternoon, say, well, the market is saying they don't have faith in the government. Well, why is it then that they're all selling the stocks of private corporations and buying United States Treasury bonds? They're fleeing into Treasury bonds. That's a flight to quality. What it shows is that when you get into a crisis of this sort, a properly run government is the one way out of it, but it's got to be properly run, and that's where Balky is falling down. We'll be back in a minute.
This is the GCN Radio Network, home to hard-hitting talk radio.
Back to World Crisis Radio. This is Webster Tarpley in Washington, D.C., inviting you once again to consider the purchase of my books, Obama, the Postmodern Coup, The Making of a Manchurian Candidate, at Amazon.com and other fine retailers. Barack H. Obama, that's Barack Hoover Obama, as Bruce Marshall points out in a fine article available at Rents.com and elsewhere, ActIndependent.org. Barack H. Obama, The Unauthorized Biography. That's also available at Amazon.com. And coming soon now, approaching the press, Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide to the Worst Financial Crisis of Human History. That's a, I guess we can call it an underground classic, written by me 10 years ago right now. Basically identifies all of the main tendencies. I think it can stand up to anybody else in forecasting, actually superior. A lot of people who are claiming they forecast this depression were actually, they were forecasting hyperinflation back in 1995 and 1996, even as the Commodity Research Bureau index was approaching an all-time low back then. Now, let's just look at a couple of things. And, of course, if you want to get Surviving the Cataclysm, shoot an email to info@progressivepress.com, info@progressivepress.com. It's got a program for saving your own situation as far as is possible within the framework of a world breakdown crisis. And it's limited, but everybody, of course, has a natural law, metaphysical right to survive, or at least to try to. It tells you how to do that also. Let's just look at a couple of things. The final breakdown on the stimulus bill, $787 billion. Now, total spending of this, $575 billion. The rest are tax cuts. Tax cuts, I guess, fine in the sense of if you think of them as emergency relief to families, but they don't produce a recovery. So the problem with that is if you don't produce a recovery in the meantime, you're going to have to come back and cut taxes again next year, and eventually with a government of this size, the more you cut taxes, the more you're undermining economic activity, unless you go into big deficit spending, which you can also do. Let's look at the breakdown. $21 billion for health information technology. Financial incentives to Medicaid, Medicare providers to use modern computer technology for medical records. Well, wait a minute. If it's economical, why don't they do it automatically? Is that a Daschle proposal to get totalitarian control over everybody's medical records? I'm not sure. Health insurance, $25 billion, health insurance assistance for the unemployed. Good. Keep it. Increase it. Assistance to unemployed families, $40 billion to extend emergency unemployment benefits. Great. Multiply that by 10. $18 billion, child support and other family assistance. Yes. You're going to need general assistance welfare and aid to mothers with dependent children. You're going to need more of it than they put in here. The various tax provisions, of course, we will skip over. Temporary increase in federal medical assistance, $90 billion. That's good. But National Coordinator for Health Information Technology, no, don't need it, and other things. Now, let's look at the infrastructure part. $28 billion for highway construction, it's better than nothing, but rather low. I mean, given the size of the bill, it's less than 10%, or it's 5% of the whole thing, if it's that. So $28 billion for highway construction, multiply that by about 5 or 10. $21 billion other transportation programs, $13 billion housing assistance programs. Some of this is fine. $55 billion grants to states to fully fund education budgets. Sure, you're going to compete in the 21st century with a collapsed school system? That may be good for the free marketeers, but not for the rest of us. Energy and water. $17 billion energy efficiency and renewable energy programs. Waste of money. Gangrene economy. Every gangrene job you create, you become poorer. The more gangrene jobs you have, the worse off you are. So forget that one. $6 billion federal loan guarantees for renewable energy systems and electrical transmission. Again, gangrene. Don't need it. Save $6 billion right there. Modernizing the nation's electricity grid, $22.4 billion, and $5 billion for the Army Corps of Engineers. But within all this, one item stands out. If you want to have serious energy, it's got to be nuclear energy. Any fool knows that. Anyone who is not blinded by Malthusian ideology and anti-science, anti-technology, anti-industrial hysteria. Here in the Washington Examiner, little item, pro-nuclear loan program dropped from the stimulus, and I read, a proposal to increase a loan guarantee program for innovative energy projects by $50 billion has been stripped out of the economic recovery package after environmentalists argued it would primarily benefit the nuclear industry. Now, these, of course, are the rich elitists, the rich Malthusian elitists who think that polar bears, snail darters, and spotted owls are more important than whether your kids go to college and whether you have a decent standard of living. In other words, modern class consciousness, the hatred of the rich for blue-collar workers, the hatred and fear of the industrial working class, which is typical of financiers, is expressed today under Malthusian ideological categories. Case in point, Paulson, the architect of the TARP and at the same time a leading environmentalist advocate. Now, if you're going to have a recovery, you got about 105 nuclear plants in the U.S. right now. Most of them are obsolete. Most of them are approaching the end of their possible lifetime. They've got to be urgently replaced by 100 at least, 110, better yet 200. Then let's go with 100 for the moment. Pebble bed, fourth generation, high temperature nuclear reactors and big ones, not by windmills, not by solar cells, not by these jokes, but the serious stuff. The base load has got to be shifted into nuclear. Save your coal, sure. If you're concerned about carbon, it's overblown, but if you're concerned about coal and carbon, save that for petrochemical. That's where you're going to need it. It turns out that the measure was put in by a reactionary. Who else? Robert Bennett, Republican of Utah, had gotten the measure put into the stimulus bill, but he confirmed that the provision had been removed from the final bill in the House Senate Conference Committee. This amendment authorized doubling an existing $42 billion loan guarantee program. It's not even money. It's insurance for loans. Doubling of a $42 billion loan guarantee program established in 2005 for technologies that do not emit or are designed to capture carbon dioxide. So now the rich elitists, the Sierra Club, the Canoe Federation, the Friends of the Earth, the Wilderness Society, all the rich elitists come forward and say, wait a minute, it's true that we don't want to have carbon emissions, but we hate nuclear also. With that, human civilization is put into a straitjacket. Poverty, disease, filth, collapsing standards of living are all built in. So get the nuclear, get 100 nuclear reactors, a transcontinental maglev, a space program, TVAs for the various river valleys that have not been done, and that you will have a recovery. Now, let's think for a second about Lincoln. Last week we had Lincoln's birthday. We need to think about Lincoln. What was Lincoln's economic approach? Was Lincoln a free market guy back there? He certainly counts as a founding father, doesn't he? Greatest man of the 19th century, probably greatest president by many estimates. What kind of economic approach did he have? He was for the free market, right? He was basically an Austrian or a Chicago boy. Well, no, when we look at it, what we find, first of all, is the greenbacks, that he decided, of course, that you couldn't remain on the gold standard when the British in London, in the London gold market, controlled the world price of gold. the British would have used gold-based financial warfare to bankrupt the Union during the Civil War in order to let their friends in the Confederacy, the slavocrats down there, win the Civil War. So you had to get off the gold standard and go to a managed national currency. Those were the greenbacks. And if we had kept the greenbacks beyond the crime of 1873, beyond the Specie Resumption Act, we would have had an unstoppable economic boom. Lincoln was also going with the moral tariff, the highest protective tariff in the history of the U.S., made possible because the Confederates had left the Congress. He was going with the building of a transcontinental railroad, an act of dirigism and government intervention. And the moral tariff and the moral act, the building of the land grant colleges, all dirigistic. So Abraham Lincoln, free market, not. And that's, again, a guide. We'll get back to Franklin D. Roosevelt, the more modern form of this, in coming weeks as we continue our attack on Calamity Schles. But in the meantime, Obama the postmodern coup, Obama the unauthorized biography, and coming soon, surviving the cataclysm. We'll see you next week.